listening to The Bradshaw Boys, a podcast where three relatively grown men binge the iconic HBO series Sex and the City. So dust off those DVDs and grab yourself a white wine or even a Cosmopolitan and settle in. Take it away, boys.
Bradshaw Boys, a podcast where three guys talk culture and relationships through the lens of Sex and the City. I'm Corey Cavan.
I'm Kevin James Doyle.
My name is John Sieber.
And today we have such a treat. We have a writer and producer for a little show that we just finished watching called Sex and the City. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome Amy B. Harris.
Ooh.
Amy, thank you so much for coming on the podcast.
Oh, thanks you guys for having me. The Bradshaw Boys. Come on, I had to come.
I mean a lot of negative things happening on Twitter, but one positive thing, we've connected with Kristen Davis and now Amy Harris.
Absolutely.
Both of you came on the podcast because of Twitter. Yeah. So thank you.
Totally. Exactly.
That's right. I did. I know. I don't usually love Twitter, but when nice things come from it, I'm pretty into it.
this is like the best thing that we've had come from it is connecting with people like you, because like we will put things out there and like we get, you know, weird replies from people and stuff like that. And usually what happens, because I run the Twitter, I'll just scroll through and then get stuck in a hole. And 20 minutes later, I'm like, what am I doing? And so these are the best things is to have something like this come out.
Yeah. I have to say, the show I'm doing right now just launched, and Twitter's been so fun because people are talking about the show and I get to respond and hear what people think. So that part of Twitter, I really love. The part where people troll you and are super mean, less into.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's an appropriate response.
Well, let's start off. You're a veteran of the TV industry now and pretty prolific, and we'll get through your whole filmography because we're big fans of
we didn't talk about it all.
But how did you, cause Sex and the City looks like the first show that you worked on.
Mm-hmm.
And
that's
how did that happen?
Yeah. And I guess what's your history even before that, Sex and the City?
Yeah. So I worked for Vanity Fair magazine. That was my first job out of college. I was an editorial assistant. And Darren Star, you guys may have heard of him.
Yeah.
He created Sex and the City. He was doing a show called Central Park West, which took place at a magazine in New York and was going to be centered around editorial assistants. And his little brother, we went to nursery school and elementary school together, and our families had been friends for years. And our beach places were right by each other. And I was obsessed with 90210 and Melrose Place and thought he was the most like amazing hero of Potomac, Maryland that there ever was. And he said, I'd actually like to pick your brain about working at a magazine. So I met with him and told him all about it. And then I decided to write him a letter because there wasn't really email. And said, if there's a job on the show in any shape or form, I would love it. I was his assistant on a show called Central Park West, which lasted a year. And then I went on as a producer onto Sex and the City because I would sit in the writer's room on Central Park West and did a lot more stuff than just assistant work. And he promoted me. And then I was Michael Patrick King, who I've worked with now many times on many different shows. He does not remember the story this way, but I remember having read a script that had come in a freelance script. And he was like, hadn't had a chance to read it yet. And he was like, how is it? And I was like, it needs some work. I think you're going to be disappointed here. And I swear to this day, because it is what inspired me to write, but he was like, I would never say anything like this. So no, that he said, writing is hard. It's not it's not as easy as it looks. You should try it. And he said, I would just never say anything like that. Whatever he said, I heard you should, like, it is challenging. You can read something and be critical, but actually trying it is something else. So I did, and I decided to write a spec script for the show. Because I think I always secretly wanted to be a writer, but I just didn't know even how to go about doing that. And I wrote a spec script and I said to Michael and to Darren, I'm writing a spec script. I don't expect a job on this show, but I think I'd like to try to be a writer. And I knew it must have been pretty okay because Michael said to me, I want to talk to you about it. And then Darren said, I think I lost this draft you gave me. Can you resend me a new one? So I knew Michael had said it was good.
That's awesome.
And then, yeah. And then it was, I had Samantha becoming a lesbian in it. And that was something we ended up using in the show. We didn't end up using my script itself, but we did use that storyline. Yeah. And then I moved on to the writing staff and I basically got to, you know, I was an apprentice at like, you know, Harvard or whatever, you know, whatever the top of the top is. It was like, I was suddenly being given an opportunity and to learn. Like Michael Patrick sat with me the night before my first table read and, you know, punched up every joke, went through every line. We talked about what worked, what didn't. He just wanted me to succeed. And it was the most protective, loving experience a person could ever have. Yeah, it was nice.
Amazing.
Oh,
go ahead, John.
We've talked to some people about the writer's room, but obviously never someone that was inside the room.
Yeah.
What were there any, we heard a rumor that everything that was written had to have come from someone's real life experiences. Is that a true story? And do you have any fun memories or something that sticks out?
That isn't entirely true. We definitely cannibalized our own dating lives to the point where we barely could date because we'd come in with a story and then sort of destroy relationships. But often it would, you know, because you're either with someone who's like, is that going to be in Sex and the City? Is that like, they're excited and then you're creeped out. Or they're like, please don't talk about this in the room. Please don't talk about this. And then of course you do talk about it in the room and then they feel betrayed. So it was rough. Mm-hmm. The stories didn't necessarily have to happen to you as much as like, and sometimes we would, like, I had a friend who, someone wrote, I love you on a cookie for the first time. And we gave that story to Miranda.
Yes.
It didn't happen to me, but and it happened to a man who ate the cookie and then like they broke up 2 weeks later. Cause she was like, are we going to talk about the fact that I said, I love you? And it was like, there was a big conversation in the room. Like, well, it's sort of a weird way to tell someone you love them, like be brave enough to say it in person.
Yes.
Yeah.
I think it's pretty brave to say it in icing, but I guess whatever.
I mean, give them credit, but then you can just eat it and pretend you missed somehow the icing, which is what my friend did. So yeah, you had to like, and a lot of the personal stories, the romantic stories were told, were always intimate. I sometimes think we pumped them up. Mm-hmm. In order to make sure that they were funny or dramatic. Mm-hmm. And then some stories were just, you know, New York lore, things that like were happening in New York. Like I went in a hard hat. My friend worked for the Soho House before it opened in New York and she lived in London. And so I went in a hard hat and like came to the room like, oh my God, there's going to be a pool and a rooftop and like, you're going to need a card and it's a club. And this is so exciting.
Oh my gosh.
So then we ended up shooting there and they literally were filling the pool because the place wasn't done with like hose water. It was so cold. Only Willie Garson would get in because were like, it's like 50 degrees. We tried to get them in at their waist and like at least two of them couldn't even say their lines. So we pulled them and sat them on the thing. But Willie was like, I'll just get in and try to stay warm enough to manage this. So, but it was freezing. So yeah, we always tried to, and what we've noticed happened a lot on the show is as our friendships got more intimate, the girls, the writers in the room and Michael, we were this very tight knit, intimate group who really supported each other. I did not know how special that room was until I went into some more rooms that were more dysfunctional. And my goal has always been since then as a showrunner is to recreate that environment where people feel safe and like they can tell intimate stories. Because when you tell intimate, authentic stories, you can give it specificity. And then I think characters feel real, which I think is the most important thing when you're trying to fall in love with a show. So I think it helped deepen the characters' mm-hmm. experiences. But mm-hmm. for example, like none of us had a child when Miranda had a baby. So mm-hmm. we were going off of other people's experiences and friends and things we knew about having a baby, but none of us had experienced that or done that at the time.
Okay.
Yeah. Once you tried writing, if the Michael Patrick King saying that, like, it's harder than it looks, what was it like to try for your first time? Was it as hard as you thought and or easier, or why?
I cried every day for at least 3 hours trying to write my first script for the show, because I didn't want to fail. I didn't want to disappoint people who I loved and were my partners, and, you know, saw beautiful drafts come in and was like so blown away. So I was terrified. I am somebody, I've also realized, who, while I'm trying to sit down at the computer, hates writing desperately and wants to quit. Even to this day, I despise the act of trying to sit down and start writing. Once I'm in scenes and I'm finding things I'm interested in, I start to love it and love the thing I'm doing. But the actual sit down for me is kind of a difficult and nauseating experience. The one thing Michael did say to me at the time, I also didn't realize how high the stakes were. Like, if I turned in a bad script, they probably would have either had to demote me back down to like the job I'd been doing, or just laterally, like, but to a job I didn't want to do anymore.
Yeah.
Or like, that hadn't dawned on me that that was like a possibility. I think if that had, I would have cried instead of for 3 hours a day. It would have been for the entire day. But the thing Michael said to me very early on was, it's not the first draft that says you can do this. It's how you take the notes that gets you to your second draft. Mm. And I thought that that was an incredibly helpful and I can turn in a bad draft, get a lot of really good notes, and if I can take them and address that, then that's the success, not the failure of the first draft that maybe didn't work.
Okay.
Also, in that writer's room, we break stories together.
Okay.
And that's how I do it always. Like, everybody's in the room breaking story. You are putting beats on the board together. So by the time you go to outline, it's something you've all worked on. The thing I didn't have at that time with inexperience was the realization, like, I didn't know when something wasn't working. Mm-hmm. Now when I have a script, I'm like, you know, this storyline is super weird. I want to go back into the room, or I'm going to try something else entirely. And now I have the freedom to do that. But when, as an inexperienced writer and someone who didn't know like how much I could move stuff around, I couldn't tell when something wasn't working. It didn't trigger for me yet.
Can you give us a peek inside as to what that process looks like? If you were to write an episode of Sex and City, where would you start? Would you start with the Carrie storyline? Are you going to start with like what's happening in this season? How does that get made?
Yeah, we would start with like big arcing of the entire season. And so you'd have the four girls' names on this side of the board, and then the episode numbers on the top. Mm-hmm. So down, and then we'd start sort of pinpointing where we thought stuff would be, like maybe in episode 5, this happens to Carrie. And we tried to, we talked about it as like biorhythms. Like if Carrie was getting out of a relationship, then maybe Miranda wasn't in a relationship and Samantha was getting into a relationship and Charlotte could be like in a steady relationship. So we tried to make sure like we weren't exploring the same idea in any of the episodes for the girls, like that they were each kind of doing their own thing. So Carrie's stories really helped us sort of arc the whole season. Mm-hmm. And then we would have general ideas about where each of the characters were going. But then once you were in an episode, it'd be like, okay, Carrie is breaking up with Aiden, at Charlotte's wedding. She has to tell him she cheated. So a happy classic relationship. Yeah.
Oh, perfect Carrie. Timing. Perfect timing there exactly. To break that
just
one.
Like, yeah. But just like making sure Charlotte didn't feel it. But so one relationship ending as another one is, you know, going the distance. Mm-hmm. And then we would start talking themes, like what thematically is happening here. And then sometimes, so if we had two stories like that, it was very clear to us that Charlotte and Carrie were, those were their big story plot lines. And then once you start talking about theme, okay, that gives us a great story for Samantha about X, or a funny runner for Miranda about Y. Mm. And then sometimes it would be, okay, Miranda has a really big, deep story here, and the other two stories are going to come to us as we're talking about, you know, what the theme is.
Yeah.
So sometimes you would know all four story arcs pretty clearly in an episode, but often it would just be Carrie's and one other, and then the themes would sort of start playing for you.
It's interesting because it's like, I mean, what you're doing in TV is like you are building this world, but then it kind of sounds like you're just sitting around being like, okay, so this season, what if Carrie does this? And then someone's like, have you been to that trapeze place? And they're like, well, what if that is like her risk taking, but it's this thing? And someone's like, I went and this guy works there. And it just, it's like you're weaving this weird tapestry of it.
Yes. You clearly have recently watched the show too. I love it.
Oh yeah. We'd never seen the show, you know, like the whole thing of our podcast is we'd never seen it. And we just finished. Two weeks ago.
Yeah.
Oh my God.
And I don't know if you know
more about episodes than I will, because I don't think I've seen an episode in 2 years, and I need to now rewatch to get ready.
Yeah. We spoke to Sarah Jessica a couple months ago when she did an episode with us, and she was telling us the same thing where she was like, I haven't watched any of those in a while.
Yeah.
So she was like, what episode does this happen in?
I literally was like, I could not tell you Samantha or Miranda's story in that wedding episode. So I was like, it could be X or it could be Y. I was like, really, I don't remember because, you know, I haven't seen it in probably 5 years. Maybe longer. I tend not to rewatch. I'm always, when I find it on TV and I do rewatch, I'm always like so pleasantly like thrilled, but I don't tend to like go back just to watch.
Yeah.
Since I can barely keep up with the TV that's out there right now, it's hard for me, but I should probably do a trip down memory lane one day.
Well that was like a weird decision for us, that it's like there's 150 good television shows like an hour coming out, and people are saying like, you got to watch this. And then we're like, we're going to watch a show from 20 years ago. And
I love it.
But it's crazy because there's a lot of shows that I like, but when something holds up, it holds up. And it's pretty impressive how much it's like, how many shows I've seen episodes of that are clearly like the watered down version of Sex and the City. And, and I don't know, it was just having just finished it, it was a much more enjoyable television watching experience than a lot of the more recent shows that like I've heard are really good that I've watched. So it really holds up in like, wildly good.
I was so surprised by when I rewatched a couple of episodes a few years ago. I was like, this show feels really fresh and current still. Like it doesn't feel dated. And I thought maybe it would, because New York was a very specific thing during that time.
Sure.
And yet I think it's because the emotions and the friendships and the relationships feel like they could exist during any, you know, maybe not during the pandemic, but during any other time.
Did you, at what point did you kind of realize, or did you ever realize, that you were writing parts of New York kind of into existence? I mean, there was a certain level of power in writing that show, where if you write about Magnolia Bakery, Magnolia Bakery is now a thing. If you write about this,
it's
only
in for 30 seconds.
Yeah, you are literally
what it is forever.
Scripting the future of what New York City is. And did you ever feel the weight of that?
Did you guys ever just hold it over a place and be like, you know, we're not going to write about you? You're like, get out of here, Ken's Broom Street Bar. We're going to shut you down.
I do remember once saying, like, we should make a drink. It was me, I think Michael and Jenny Bix. We were like, we should make a drink up. And we did. We made the Flirtini, and then we wrote it in, and it became a drink.
Oh, yes. That's that's amazing that you created that.
That was the craziest.
It's Corey's favorite drink.
I love a Flirtini. I had three tonight before the podcast.
That's like playing God. You're just like, watch now.
That was the weirdest thing. That was like the only time. And it seems so like, I was like, there's no way that's going to be a drink that takes off. And then, because one of the things that was lovely about filming in New York when we did, it was really Law and Order, which is obviously like its own juggernaut. Mm-hmm. And then it was two HBO shows. It was Us and Sopranos. Mm-hmm. And so, and they were, you know, it's like this massive hit. And so, but we were all just in the same, we were all at Silver Cup Studios. Like, you know, Jimmy Gandolfini would be walking by in his bathrobe at 2 o'clock in the afternoon to go shoot a morning scene.
Oh,
as
man.
Our girls were walking down the hallway in clippity cloppity heels at 3 o'clock in the afternoon, shooting a club scene. And we were just this little like Silver Cup engine that could. So we'd never, I think in the best way, like I did know we were becoming this like bigger thing, but we were also sort of living in our own like lovely bubble of,
yeah,
like just like they have a better craft service table than we did. You know, it wasn't like it was this very lovely. I mean, and it the flirtini thing was like, oh, it ended up on menus. Okay, that was weird. And just seeing how certain places hit because of us, obviously that became like a crazy thing. Mm-hmm.
Did you feel like, because we've talked about this just with us watching the show. We talk about the whole thing of trying to like enjoy a moment and stay in it. And it's like funny for watchers where we're like, oh, I've brought this up a million times in our podcast, but like before I watched The Wire, a friend of mine was like, I wish that I could tell you what journey you're about to go on, because you'll never have not watched it. And that's how we felt with this show. And when we finished it, and I talked about it like the day that we finished it, there was like a palpable, Kevin texted me the next day and he was like, I woke up sad today. And it's like, but there was a thing, because it's like you finish a thing, but, and I've read things about other writers on other shows where they were like, we were doing this thing that we didn't realize became a cultural landmark. And then looking back on it, you're like, oh my gosh, like we were in it, but we just didn't know. Like, did you feel that when the show was over or anything? Or were you able to kind of appreciate it as it was happening?
I think I was the most annoying person probably the last year, because I would be like, this is the last first table read.
Yeah.
This is the last first blah, blah, blah. Like Michael at one point was like, stop doing that. You're making me crazy. Because I thought this phenomenon that I'm a part of is going away. It was like this family that I have, this intimate, like the crew always stayed year in and year out, this cast, like the writers, we were so close and we still are, we all are still close. And like, I just literally got a text from Elisa Zaritsky about something else. And Julie Rottenberg and I talked yesterday, and Jenny Bix and I have a phone date tonight. You know, it's like, we're Michael and I talked 5 times this weekend. So we're all still super tight, but I did realize like we were going to be leaving this like beautiful family. I knew no matter what, that wasn't going to exist for us when that last scene shot where, you know, they said cut for the last time. And that's what really, and I was deep in my feels on that. I knew I was very emotional, and I think Sarah, I might be wrong, but I think Sarah Jessica, like almost like instantaneously, like when they old cut, started crying. I don't know if it's true or that's how I remember it, or I was crying so much. I thought everyone must be, but it was, I knew we had done something. I knew there would be other experiences I had in writing and creating and producing that would be fulfilling. But I really did understand like that is like a once, like flash, you know, once in a lifetime. It's like lightning in a bottle. Like everybody loved each other. I loved writing for those actors. I loved the crew. People loved the show, and it was critically acclaimed. Like, I don't know if you ever, like, that felt like to me, like I understood how good that was.
Do you feel like, we want to talk about some of the specific episodes that you wrote, but do you feel like with the, how different things are today with social media, we were talking about Twitter, do you think you could have had that same experience on a show with such an iconic show in today's climate of how TV has changed? Cause it's like the flirtini thing. You're like I've worked on on some like TV shows where the thing has been, we have to create a viral thing. And that'll be the thing this week is let's try to do a stunt where we get it trending. And you guys kind of did it as a joke and then it became a thing. And there was no way there, and there was no way for any of you to tell the world, hey, we didn't mean to do this.
Right. Yeah.
So you're getting kind of a weird echo chamber.
I don't know. I mean, I have a show that just launched on Friday. So I've been on Twitter. I'm in like a Twitter hole at the moment. Like, get out, Amy. You have work to do. And I don't know. I guess because it's also, it hasn't been very mean on Twitter so far that I, and also because things stream now, like this is a show on Amazon. So we just wrote in a bubble, which is what we sort of did on Sex and the City. And then we put it out there and people either responded or they didn't. I imagine when it's faster paced with like network and you are trying to respond in like more real time, I imagine that would be harder, but yeah. With streaming, I mean, I finished that show. We finished filming in March and wrapped post in June, and it came out like, so we've, you know, we've been in a total other bubble with it. So I didn't feel the pressure to sort of make it viral and make it this, but again, probably one of those things where I should have, and I guess I'm glad I didn't, because I don't, because I always think you're better off if you're writing from a place of like, these are the things I'm interested in and want to talk about. And these are stories that I've experienced or someone else has experienced. I always think those are better anyway. You kind of can't guess what's going to go viral. Like, I'm always so surprised by the things I see that go viral, because they're never exactly what you would have. It's like that, that kook slam with a dog is the thing. Okay. Like, I kind of get it, but I also kind of don't get it. I get why I loved it, but I'm surprised a million people made it trend. So I think you just don't know. And you sort of have to like, not write to please yourself, but just write to what you know and are interested in or want to know more about.
Well, speaking of writing some of those things, like you, like we said, and you've written, we have that you've written 57 episodes. I know that you said a lot of it was like by committee, by what you guys did it. And
I did
like,
not write 57 episodes of that
we
show.
We need to talk to the people at IMDb. That is what they told us.
Sex in the City, I produced all of those, but I was, I think I, and I was a writer on, I think 70 or 80 of them.
Yep.
But I only wrote two.
Oh, wow.
Okay. So what are the ones that you, what are the ones that you wrote? Do you remember?
So I wrote Hop, Skip, and a Week.
Yep.
And Ring a Ding Ding.
Okay.
Okay.
Yeah. So those are my two.
So Hop, Skip, and a Week. I have a specific question. Hop, Skip, and a Week is the one right before Post-It sticks twice? And Hop, Skip, and a Week is the one where the Post-It happens?
No. So the Post-It is in Hop, Skip, and a Week.
It's in Hop, Skip, and a Week.
It ends with the Post-It. And then,
So did you...
Is that right?
I believe it is. We talked about this before because
and
it's not
in... And then Ring a Ding Ding is where she realizes she spent all her money on shoes and can't afford her apartment.
Yes.
Right. Yeah.
And did you realize... Charlotte lends her ring to get the apartment.
Did you how did the Post-It idea, how did you all come up with that? And did you realize that was going to be such a huge thing?
I'm 99.9% sure that Liz DiCillo, who wrote the next episode, had said, what's the weakling way someone would break up with someone? And she said, if someone broke up with me on a Post-It, I would kill them. And we were like, oh, well, that's it.
Oh my gosh. That's Berger.
Berger. Gosh, you know, it's really like the tell of like, don't marry, like don't date your own, like a mirror version of yourself, because whatever the insecurities are, they're just like tenfold in whatever's happening.
Wow.
That's always, we always thought Berger was like the perfect person to her until you realize, you know, another writer and this and that. And then you're suddenly like, oh, we're in competition and this is awful.
It was such a weird experience, like watching something for the first time while thousands of people like listen to our podcast and would just be like, we love Ron Livingston from like everything else he's been in.
Yeah.
And people, and I'm like, oh dude, Ron Livingston's in this. And then people would be like, just fucking wait. You're going to hate Berger. And I was like, geez, why? They're like, just wait. Just people screaming at us.
Ron is like the greatest guy ever. So it's like, so poor Ron that it's like, he's the jerk who like broke up with her on a Post-it. It's horrible.
Yeah, it was it was really funny because even the first episode we're like, this guy's great, like we like Berger, and people, I mean, it was an interesting way to watch it. So
yeah, no, I'm glad you got to see it without knowing that he, you know, it's mostly just like nowadays it's nothing. People ghost people all the time. You break up with texts. Like actually a Post-it is almost kind because it's like a little piece of paper you can hold on to. But yeah, no, that was one of those things where that was really like laughing in the room. Like, is that too much? And then it's like, yeah, maybe it's just right.
Wow.
Yeah. I have a question about when you wrote episodes away from New York. I mean, they always say that New York is kind of a fifth character. And there's episodes that were written in the Hamptons, in Los Angeles. There's one that takes place in Atlantic City. Was that something that you all considered and was particularly difficult writing those four iconic women outside of their place that they were most comfortable?
Their natural habitat.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, we certainly use that as the Paris. The Paris ones are very much about like, don't take Carrie out of her natural habitat. Yep. This is bad.
Mm-hmm.
Hi, everybody. I'm Katie Segal.
And I'm Kurt Sutter.
And welcome to our new podcast called Pi, People, Influences, and Experiences.
Yes, it's sort of the get to know you at a deeper level, the who, what, when, where, and why you are, rather than what it is you do.
Absolutely. We're not going to talk too much about what people do. We just want to know about their families, where they come from, you know, what shapes their parenting if they have kids, what shapes their marriages if they're married. We just want to be really nosy. We want to get in there.
A deep dive into nature and nurture.
And we started it because there are a lot of people that we don't know that we are curious about.
Right. And I have no friends. So for me, it's, you know.
Trying to get them out of the house.
Listen to it on whatever you listen to podcasts on.
Yeah, podcast, homecast.
Your podcasting apparatus. Watch it on the YouTube.
He's aging himself.
Ladies and gentlemen.
What are you doing?
What do you mean?
Keep it simple.
I'm making the promo.
Just keep it simple. Just say, hey, we're the Brav Bros. Two guys that talk about Bravo.
Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, we're the Brav Bros.
No.
Oh.
Dude, stop with the voice. Keep it simple.
I've seen promos on TV, dude. This is how you get the fans engaged. This is how you get listeners. We're trying to get listeners here. If we just say, oh, we're two dudes that talk about Bravo, people are going to get tired of it already. We need some oomph.
All right, then fine. Let's try to do it with your voice.
Brav Bros.
Good job.
Okay, we're good.
Yeah, okay. We lost audio there for 2 seconds. Okay.
Yeah, but you're fine.
I was just going to say, I think like a show like Succession does this amazingly well, and they really celebrate this. Like rich people go to places, and that's where a story should happen. And even though you're supposed to be on sets and stages that make it cheaper and easier to make something, you like, fuck it. We're going to the Amalfi Coast. We're going. Mm-hmm. So, and I love that show for so many reasons, but that's one of the ones I really love. Like that's so real. And I think what we did on Sex and the City is that is real. People certainly in New York go to the Hamptons. That is absolutely a place where New Yorkers go. Mm-hmm. And if you're Carrie and you have a book of articles that are becoming, like a Candace Bushnell Sex and the City book, you go to Hollywood where they want to option your book. Yeah. So then we had to figure out like what stories we wanted to tell in the Hamptons, in Los Angeles, in Atlantic City. Sorry, that's my home line, which never rings. So forgive me.
Don't worry about it. It's real.
Yeah. So we would just have to be like, okay, what are those stories? Like, why did we decide to go there? And what are the stories we're telling there that are slightly different?
Sure. Mm-hmm. Yeah. That makes sense.
But I mean, yeah, it was definitely like fish out of water. So we wrote that scene, like one of my favorite scenes in the LA episodes, which are like a fever dream for me because of how bonkers that whole experience was, because we were filming during the convention in 2000, the LA convention, Democratic convention, and everything was being shut down. It was chaos. I mean, I literally was a fever dream. But my favorite scene is when they walk out of the Standard Hotel and just they see the traffic going by and they just walk right back in. Like, they're just like, we don't understand the city and how would we cross the street? And like, that stuff made me laugh. Yeah.
That's really funny.
Yeah. We were all New Yorkers who didn't understand LA. I'm now someone who does live in LA, so I get it now. But to write the sort of like a New Yorker here was like really fun, because we were all people who were like, what's LA?
You can get in trouble for jaywalking? What?
Yeah, what? Why?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
Get a life. I still jaywalk in Beverly Hills and everyone's like, what are you doing? I'm like, God, I guess I will get a ticket, but whatever.
That's so funny.
Have you ever gotten a ticket for jaywalking?
I haven't.
Oh, so that could just be a rumor that people spread.
No, I think it's real. I think now things are so chaotic, it's like, forget it. But I do think it was real and like in sort of Beverly Hills proper. Okay. They don't want you racing across the street. But
yeah.
I got away with it.
What was it like? What was it like? Because we haven't seen Carrie Diaries. But what was it like creating
that? And that's your next thing.
I know. I mean,
we have to watch the movies. That's our next thing. And then we're looking for other things to watch after that.
What was it like working on that with, like, now at this point you have like a character that is a, you know, you're not starting from scratch. You're like, okay, we're making this show. You know, it's a prequel, which are super fun, but
it was terrifying. Mm-hmm. I felt the weight of the world and the responsibility of the show on my back. Mm-hmm. I did not want to fuck that up. Are you allowed to curse? I have the worst mouth.
Yeah,
so
absolutely.
Yeah. Okay. It's the internet. We embrace it.
Woohoo. I'm crazy. So I felt a lot of pressure. Michael had originally, they had come to Michael and said, do you want to do the prequel? And he couldn't, but said, I really just want it to be Amy, if it's going to be anybody, because I think she's the one who would most protect the franchise. Wow. Which I was very honored and grateful to do. And I felt like I had a lot to say, like, about like what the Carrie Diaries is really Carrie pre-sex and pre-love. So like, to me, it was very like, I think initially I'm sure they wanted like the girls in their 20s and it like baby Muppets, like, you know, baby Samantha, baby. Mm-hmm. And I was like, I want to slowly start showing these other, our main characters as we go along in success. But the first season just has to be sort of like watching Carrie fall in love for the first time. And I had a lot to, I mean, my new show is about being a teenager. I had a lot to say and still do about coming of age and what that experience feels like. And there were certain things I wanted to change. Like, I know really agreed with this decision. So it was interesting that I then just sort of redid it in the prequel. The idea that Carrie's father had left, and that's something that's in Sex and the City, that her dad had left her, and that's why she struggled with relationships, maybe, if you want to therapize about it. I personally have a very good relationship with my father and was deeply close with him. He just passed this year. So I wanted to write a story about when you have wonderful male relationships and you're not searching, like, that makes it harder to fall in love, because you're really looking for something bigger than just like a daddy figure or someone to fill the hole. It's like, to me, so Carrie's father was alive and the mother had passed, and so it was about a father raising two girls, which I mean, my mom is alive, but I took a lot. Well, Carrie Diaries was very much a love letter to my father and to the kind of relationships it kind of helped me create. So I just tried to write from a really authentic place about who I thought Carrie would be, but I knew it wouldn't be for everyone. I'm sure like Michael and Sarah Jessica were like, no, she would never, you know, like, But I just had to figure out, I thought, again, the more authentic and specific I could be about it, the better.
That's
and the
cool.
better for the show. Yeah.
It's so
and it had Candace's book. So there was some stuff that was just taken from Candace's book.
Right.
And then I just tried to infuse it as much as possible with what I knew about being a teenager.
There's that, one that makes me super excited. Like we feel obligated to watch to watch it just because it's next, but that makes me so excited to to watch it and just getting to talk to you and be like, oh, cool. Like knowing that it came from a place like that rather than just like, okay, like let's watch the prequel. That makes me super excited to watch it.
Yeah, totally.
No, I'm really proud of it. I think it's a very, but you know, I understand why I loved it. Like I felt like getting to write those. I took it from that was my whole thing was like, I wrote it from a very like authentic, loving place as opposed to a cynical, like how can I keep the gravy train growing? And I think that's the thing, as long as like you are working from that as a writer, like whatever the stories are, it's always like, I think you have a shot. I don't necessarily think it works, but I think you have a shot of making it work.
That's cool. We have one specific question with that. And I'm
because
we haven't seen it, I'm not sure. But when we first started watching the show, we also started watching it like not knowing if we were going to like it. And after the first episode, after the pilot, we were like, Capote Duncan. We were just like, he's the fucking coolest. And everybody was like, what is your problem? But then isn't there a Capote Duncan tie-in in Carrie Diaries? Didn't he like go to high school with her or something? Maybe it's in the book. Someone has told us. Someone's told us there's a tie-in.
This is how long it's been since I've thought about Carrie Diaries. I think it's in the bar.
There's some sort of
book.
There's some sort of tie-in. I think there's a tie-in with it. Yeah, I think it's a tie with that in the book.
He definitely didn't go to high school with Carrie, but maybe she met him somewhere along the way.
Okay.
The show's fun. She ends up working at Interview Magazine. There's a lot of fashion, and like she has an internship, and but it's definitely, there's like little, I liked laying in Easter eggs from the show. Like you'll see some stuff from Sex and the City and be like, oh yes, that's a good Easter egg. And Samantha's in the second season, which was fun.
Oh, that's awesome.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
And then, we were going to talk about the other show. Go ahead, Gavin.
Well, this is like 6 degrees of, I just did this in my head. You wrote the post-its in your episode, in Romy and Michelle's high school reunion, they invent post-its, and then
you
worked on the comeback, which when I first watched the comeback on HBO, it was the greatest thing I've ever seen in American television.
I love that show so much.
The fucking greatest, like it is so incredible. And it didn't do a second season, I cried. I was in college and I was telling everyone who liked the BBC version of The Office, I was screaming at everyone because that was like, it was before the American version. And the comeback's just the best ever. I love it.
Thank you. That is a show where, and I look back, I'm just like, we were way too early to the game.
It's ahead of its time.
Yeah. It's just like one of those things where you're like, oh my God, like even 2 years later, they would have been like, oh, somebody's already done that. But that person would have been brutalized for doing it. And we could have been like, Veep is in a very similar vein, obviously not shot the same way, but just about this sort of like difficult to love, unforgivable, like limelight needing desperate woman. I think Lisa's so brilliant in that it was almost painful for people to watch because they were like, oh my God, this is agony to watch someone just get in their own way constantly.
Totally.
But that's another thing I did with Michael, that like just one of the greatest joys of my life.
It's so cool.
And then we got a comeback. We got a comeback of a comeback. So
yeah, you get the, what was it? 10 years later or 9 years later?
Nine.
Something like that.
Yeah. 9 years later. It was so fun to come back to it. It was awesome.
That's pretty cool because that's like kind of what you're talking about with Sex and the City. Like it's over. This we'll never be back together again. Then with this other show that had, you know, it's like, it's over. We'll never be back together again. What was it like when you how did you find out 10 years later, you're going to do another, what was it like to like get the gang back together?
That was crazy. That was literally like, Michael's like, so, and we all stayed in touch. Like, I obviously, I talked to Michael a lot, very codependent with my people. and I talked to Lisa a lot, and Dan Bukatinsky, who was her producing partner and on the show. So it was bubbling, and it's like, is this real? Like, it felt like, this seems real. Like, Casey Bloys was like, I want to get this done. We love the show. And yeah, then all of a sudden it was like, okay, we're doing it. And we did it so fast. Like, that was a crazy thing. It was like me, John Rigi, Lisa, and Michael in the room. All the rest of the writers were like scattered doing other things. Like, I had a deal at Warner Brothers. So did Rigi. So we were able to kind of like jump on, cause it's a Time Warner thing. And that was like, we were in the room for like a month breaking stories and just like running off and writing. And then we were like shooting, and Michael had this crazy card table, and he would be rewriting on set, and we'd be sitting around him saying, "Ooh, try this and try that." Like, it was so fast and furious. And it was, and then, you know, Seth Rogen was like, "Yeah, I'll play Pauly G in the, you know, HBO TV show of the TV show." And so we were just like off to the race. It was thrilling. That was one of those things where you're just like, are you kidding? Because TV takes so long usually. And this was just like, we were suddenly like in a room, then we were shooting, then it was on the air. Like, it was that fast.
That's awesome.
It's so cool. It's so cool that you were also like parodying the world that you were in. Like, it's such a meta show, because you're making a show about a show, but you're also making fun of what you're doing in the moment. And
when that HBO set goes meta, you're like, that is this entire thing is meta. Even just saying, like, one of my favorite lines Michael wrote in that show, or I forget, it was Michael or Lisa, but it was like, you know, it's an HBO half comedy, which is a half hour that has no laughs, you know, just like how suddenly like we could not the thing we were doing, like so within the thing we were doing. Yeah, it was crazy.
That's so really funny. We wanted to do a couple, we've been talking for a little while. We wanted to do a couple like kind of quick questions to you.
Sure.
What if we start with, which of the four ladies from Sex and the City would you say you are?
Carrie.
Really? Okay. Oh, tell
totally.
Us why.
Totally.
Tell us why. And this has been interesting too, because like John on our podcast famously hates Carrie. I probably am the most Carrie of the three of us.
How could you hate her? She's so...
I didn't mean to out you, John, but it's like everyone that listens to it knows.
Yeah. You basically just said, after saying that she's Carrie, you basically just told her that hey, thanks a lot for that.
I told her, I hope that you noticed that I told her that you hate Carrie. And then I was like, and I am a Carrie.
And I love Carrie.
I love her. I think she's the best character ever written. You don't hate her, but you definitely like.
I get frustrated.
She's frustrated. Well, she's frustrating. I think if you talk to my husband, he would say, I'm frustrated. So there you go. First of all, I'm a writer and she's a writer. Right. So I think all the writers probably we all saw. I mean, my joke was like, I think I'm Carrie, but I probably have more Miranda than you would like, I would care to admit, or I'm happy to admit, but, you know, don't always like live in. And I'm secretly optimistic like Charlotte, and I wish I could be Samantha, but I do not have the guts to do it. But I think the reason why, I mean, as a writer, I see the complexity in things, and I'm very neurotic because of that. And I could frustratingly, before I got married, talk about my relationships and repeat the same problems in all of them over and over and over again. So John would have found me deeply annoying as a single person. I mean, I could really like reanalyze a voicemail, a text, and this, you know, it's like I was. So
all this has told me that I am a Carrie as well.
It's solidified it.
I mean, but she's also complicated and thoughtful and a good friend. And I love her.
Which of the boyfriends were you most into? Like, did you have a particular boyfriend that you vibed with?
I mean, this is weird. My dad is very much a Mr. Big. And in fact, Candace Bushnell always called him Mr. Big. And so did Sarah Jessica.
Wow. That's awesome.
So I had a soft spot for him. my dad this
hey,
sort
hey, Amy,
of like
I think yeah. I think your sound just went out. Just can you just repeat that like what you just said just at the beginning of that sentence?
Oh, sure.
Sorry.
My dad was very much like a Mr. Big, like a business person and sort of tall and dark. And so I sort of had like a soft spot for him, thinking I was going to end up marrying like something like that. Mm. But I did sort of feel like Carrie got lucky and that her Mr. Big ended up being somebody who could commit. Mm-hmm. I don't know. I really loved Aiden, but I also happen to love John Corbett so much. Mm-hmm. It's all sort of mixed up in mm-hmm. it. I could never have ended up with like a Steve, I don't mm-hmm. think. Mm-hmm. But I loved that character for Miranda. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I don't know. It's a good question.
Did you all ever think about doing a Dr. Robert Leeds and Debbie spinoff show? Who we thought were the hottest. They were the hottest characters in the show.
They were the hottest characters.
Yeah.
That would have just been the beautiful people. Like,
Debbie
just everyone would have been like,
I know, right? I know. Oh, my God. And Blair Underwood. My God.
Yeah.
He had the best male style. Like
best male style.
The greatest.
So simple.
He is the greatest ever. Yeah. Like we were all like, whenever like a new boyfriend character came in, we were just like, it was like new love, you know, we were just like, and the actor was so wonderful. Like we just got so lucky.
What was it like writing? So you write, you know, Dr. Robert Leeds, or you write Berger. Do you have these actors in mind? Obviously at that level. Okay.
No, I know. And in fact, like, we auditioned a bunch of people for Berger. I think maybe like as we were writing Robert, like we started to think like, could we get someone like Blair Underwood? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Steve was written for David Eigenberg.
Okay.
Really?
So he had come in and auditioned a bunch. And nothing was quite right. Like he'd audition for this boyfriend or that boyfriend or this boyfriend. And it was always like, oh, he's so interesting and good, but he's not quite right for this part. And mm-hmm. then, so they wrote Steve, like Jenny wrote COVID. Jenny wrote that first episode with him. Mm. And we'd been really thinking about him for that part. Like it was his, like we knew that.
I wanted to ask you before we run out of time, you, could you tell us about your new show, The Wilds, which is available on Amazon Prime now. And I just want to tell everyone before you go into it, it has a 90% critics rating on Rotten Tomatoes and even more importantly, 92% for audience.
Whoa.
So audience and critics are loving this. And tell us more about it.
I'm so nervous because, you know, it's like, it's just been a weekend of like both terror and excitement. It's an awesome show about eight girls who get stranded on a deserted island. I like to say it's Lost meets My So-Called Life. If I had to give you like just the quick one, although
that's great.
Doesn't have a supernatural element, but it has a big conspiracy element because you find out pretty quickly they're maybe not there. It might not be an accident what has happened to them. And I think it's like a beautiful coming of age story with great characters. And then there's awesome, scary, you know, stunts and action. And then there's this sort of big conspiracy it's all wrapped up in. And the cast is, I've never seen a cast of eight young actors. Rachel Griffiths is in it. She's amazing. But these eight young actors, like I've just never, like you can write, usually you're writing towards people's strengths and trying to write away from their weaknesses. And this is just like this unbelievable cast of girls who, young women, who are amazing. Yeah. Mm. So it's been very exciting to see the reviews come in. We hope, we get a second season because we have lots more to say. It ends on a big cliffhanger. It's really, I think you guys might actually like it. Like it's a coming of age story and there's lots of, but it's also like a big scary island story with, you know, survival at its most difficult. And the sort of thesis of the show is it harder to survive your teenage years or a deserted island? And I'm not sure the answer to that is always so clear.
That's awesome.
I feel like we would really love it. I hope the twist is that Capote Duncan is there.
Capote Duncan might be in it. So he shows up. You know, I can't promise you he is. I don't want to spoil it for you, but just keep watching because maybe he shows up. I don't know.
We're really, really excited to see it. That sounds really awesome.
Yeah, it's good. Very excited. I know. Well, that certified fresh for me, like when that showed up on Friday, I was like,
yes.
Yeah, that's got to be so... Yeah, that just has to be such high pressure. And so,
I can imagine.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
Well,
and also just wanting the audience to love it. So,
I mean,
that number is the one.
It's crazy. I think as a person that watches TV, it's always great to see like both of those, you know, because, I mean, that's just like, that's that extra stamp that you're like, okay, I'll check this out. So that's
very
awesome.
Good. I'm so glad. Yay.
That's so cool.
Okay, good.
Well, Amy, I know that we've talked about like being in a Twitter hole and stuff, but is there a place where people can find you online? Do you want them to find you online?
Yes,
is it just Twitter? Is it other places?
Come to my Twitter. I'm AB Harris. Yeah. Come chat. Okay. And watch the show. And I like talking to people about Sex and the City. And I like talking to people. I do love it. I mean, and even people who are mean, I'm sort of curious as to why they aren't enjoying. So I like to hear.
Cool.
As long as it's not personally mean, I'm good.
I want to end on one question. If you don't mind, it seems like you have like a caringness to you that is like, you know, even like turning in that spec script and just being like, no, I'll do it. Like to be someone who's like been a part of so many incredible like TV shows and are still doing it. Like what's like a piece of advice you'd give to like a young writer or a young television writer or a young writer, or someone who's trying to end up doing what you have spent your life doing?
I quote Michael Patrick on this regularly, like don't chase the money, chase the love and the idea. My thing when I'm about to either say yes to something is this, especially with TV, like, is this something I want to be thinking about for in success years potentially? And if my answer is yes, I cannot wait to get up and think about stories for these characters and this world and these themes, then I think like success comes. And then, you know, it's like, so for me, it's like, I just think like, it's obviously a luxury now that I get to say yes or no, and that I'm so freaking grateful for. But at the end of the day, like, I think, you, of course, like you have to take jobs. Sometimes you just have to take a job. You need to pay the rent and you do that. But when you can, if you can work on stuff you're in love with and you write ideas that you feel like are, like I always say to young writers, like when they send me material and I'm like, why'd you choose this? Because oftentimes if I can't tell why they chose it, then it's the wrong story for them to be telling as a thing they want to show to the world. But if it's like, this is the world I grew up in, or even if it's really specific, like just to be able to write about stuff you're intrigued by. And even if it's like, I really want to write the, I mean, somebody already did it, so maybe don't, but The Crown. Like, I want to write about a young Queen Elizabeth. I'm obsessed with that time period. I'm totally into the research. Like, just write about something that's super exciting for you. And that, I think, always sort of makes the difference.
Great.
I love that.
Well, Amy B. Harris, thank you so much for talking to us.
Thank you, John. I still enjoyed this, even though you clearly don't like me.
You're right. You got me.
Awesome. Well, thank you.
Seriously, guys, this is great. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Amy. Appreciate
it. Really fun. Thanks.
Everyone, go watch The Wilds. Thank you.
Go watch The Wilds.
Thank you.
The Bradshaw Boys stars Corey Cabin, Kevin James Doyle, and John Sieber. The show is produced by me, Jeremy Balin, and narrated by Katie Sieber. This podcast is part of the Seltzer Kings Network. Check out all their great podcasts at seltzerkings.com. You can find the boys on their socials at The Bradshaw Boys or on their website at thebradshawboys.com. And as always, if you see them in the street, tip your glass. Thanks for listening.